With this tutorial, I wanted to try to talk a little bit about why people who do research in the foundations of quantum mechanics and people who do research on causal inference have lots to talk about. You know, what is it that sort of brings us together? And I mean, there's actually a lot of interesting connections between these two fields. And I think a lot of synergy. And in the last few years, you know, whenever two fields that have been evolving independently kind of suddenly you realize actually there's a lot in common there, progress happens pretty quickly. So that's from our side, that's what we've been thinking. And part of the reason I think is that there's a very similar kind of structure to the fact that over in causal inference, there's been this recognition that, you know, the paradigm of statistics where you just get conclusions from the data itself has to be replaced somewhat by a causal paradigm when you bring causal hypotheses to that data. And there's a similar thing in the foundations of quantum mechanics where there's sort of this pair of paradigms. One is a totally operationalist paradigm where you just try to say, let's look only at the statistical data of experiments and nothing more. And then what you might call a more realist paradigm where people try to explain, you know, why do we see the statistical data? And so the interpretations of quantum theory are kind of down here. And I've seen, like, when I look at causal inference, I see a lot of parallels to the kinds of discussions we see in quantum foundations. And part of the reason I think is you know, when I read a little bit about Carl Pearson, he was motivated by positivism and, you know, people like Ernst Mach. And that's exactly the same sort of philosophy of science that was used by the founders of quantum theory, people like, you know, Heisenberg and Bohr, to try to, you know, that which started the whole operational paradigm. So there's a lot of parallels there. And I think that's why, you know, we're in a similar situation. I think the fact that the formulas in the conceptual scheme of causal inference ended up resolving what I would call various statistical puzzles, like Simpson's paradox and Bergson's paradox, is very significant for quantum foundations, because the lesson of that, to my mind, is that inference and causation should be clearly distinguished, both conceptually and in the formalism. And that's, for me at least, personally, something that's very much true of quantum theory as well, right? So this is one of my favorite quotes about quantum theory by E.T. Jaynes, saying that, you know, the quantum formalism is a peculiar mixture describing in part realities of nature, in part incomplete human information about nature, all scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr into an omelet that nobody has seen how to unscramble. So for many years, I was sort of focused on unscrambling the omelet of epistemology and ontology and quantum theory. And part of that is unscrambling causation and inference. And I would say we're still not quite, haven't succeeded on the quantum side in achieving that unscrambling as well as we have classically. But what I would say is, you know, to anybody who's researching the foundations of quantum mechanics, I would say to them, you really need to understand the field of causal inference, because if you don't understand how to resolve Simpson's paradox and Bergson's paradox in the, you know, setting of classical, then you really have no hope in trying to unscramble it properly on the quantum side, where everything is much more conceptually difficult. So this is why I think it's really important for people in thinking about the foundations of quantum theory to understand causal inference well. Okay, so that's part of, you know, why I'm interested, and I'm sure other people are interested. Now I want to talk a little bit about more about kind of the sense in which people working in the foundations of quantum theory have already been doing causal inference for some time. And so to try to draw the sense in which the two communities have been working on the same problem. So I'm going to start with a characterization of what I see as sort of part of the classical causal inference community's approach to certain problems. So, and then I'm just doing this to sort of set up the analogy to what's going on in quantum physics. So I'll talk a little bit about the instrumental inequality. So, you know, I imagine a situation where you have data from economics, which shows some positive correlation between getting a degree from some educational institution and having maximum wages in your future career above some threshold. Okay, so there's this positive correlation. That might lead you to think that there's a causal influence, but of course, it could be due to a common cause like aptitude, which both gives you higher wages and makes you more likely to be accepted into that institution, for example. And so the idea, you know, because you can't do a randomized controlled trial here, you know, you go looking for an instrument variable. In this example, something like admission factors unrelated to aptitude. Like if your parents gave a large donation to that institution, that might be sufficient to get you admission. And now if you see these positive correlations between wages and these other admission factors, then under this causal hypothesis, that has to be by virtue of, you know, variations here implying variations there, which is what accounts for the variations there. So you can back out some information about the causal effect of getting that degree on your maximum wages. But of course, this example is constructed because it's also plausible that there could be a direct causal effect. If your parents were wealthy enough to give a big donation, then maybe you're destined to have higher than average wages regardless of whether you got that degree or not. So you'd like to be able to test the causal hypothesis. And that's where the instrumental inequalities come in, that you can prove that for this causal structure, there are going to be constraints on the joint distribution over those three observed factors. And those are captured by the instrumental inequality. So if you violate them, you know something else must be going on, such as this direct influence. So a bit more formally, you know, if you think of this as sort of a Bayesian causal model where your parameters are the conditional probabilities of every variable given its parents, then, you know, you can compute the conditional xy given z just in terms of this Markov condition, the products of the conditionals. You marginalize over the thing that you're not observing. And in our community, we say that the distribution is compatible with a given causal structure if you can find some parameters that will yield that distribution. Good, so this would be an example of one of these, what we like to call causal compatibility inequalities. So if you violate this inequality, then it cannot be explained by this sort of causal structure. So this is one of Pearl's instrumental inequalities. Okay, so the pattern is you have some statistical data over here, over x, y, z. You have some set of causal hypotheses you're trying to adjudicate between. And you know that some of them imply things like inequalities. And because this data has chosen to violate that inequality, you know that it can't be the top option. That's not compatible. So then you have to assume some other option. Okay, so I want to show that it's the same pattern when we talk about Bell's theorem. Okay, so Bell's theorem, this is John Bell. Bell's theorem is a result from 1964. He was an Irish physicist thinking about the foundations of quantum theory, basically working on the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen puzzle and hidden variable models, particularly one due to David Bohm. And so he came up with an experiment that looks like this. Yeah, so he imagined the quantum description of an experiment like this, where you have a pair of systems, maybe particles, prepared together, brought out to separate labs. Each lab does a measurement on its particle. So you have an outcome in each, and you have some variability in what measurement's being done. So we'll call that a setting variable. So what you observe are the settings and the outcomes. So this is an example of the kind of statistics that you can get out of a Bell experiment. So over here, I have the four possible experiments where the settings are 0 on both sides, or 0 on the left, 1 on the right, et cetera. And on the top, I have the possible outcomes, 0 on both sides, 0 on the left, 1 on the right, et cetera. And so we have mostly correlation, so like about 85% correlation in the first three rows, and mostly anti-correlation in the last row. So these are the kinds of correlations that quantum theory predicts can occur in this sort of experiment. So now, from the causal inference perspective, you can say, well, let's see how we can explain that causally. And this is the natural hypothesis, that there's some common cause that acts on the two outcomes. And that's what explains the correlations. And if I look at the structure of the experiment, that's certainly what's suggested, that these, you know, particles are prepared with correlated properties. They're maybe sampled from some distribution. And that's how I get the correlations. But Bell showed that this causal hypothesis, he didn't say it in quite this way, but effectively showed that this causal hypothesis implies some constraints, which we call the Bell inequalities. Quantum theory predicts that we can violate the Bell inequalities. So in particular, these correlations violate Bell inequalities. And so these guys are incompatible. So you know this is not the correct causal explanation. OK, so it's the same pattern that you'd see for the instrumental inequalities. If you read Bell's original papers, he was certainly thinking about causality. So it's also sort of couched in causal terms. But I've just tried to make it look exactly parallel. And now at this stage, I would say, you know, there's a lot of debate among people who do research in quantum foundations as to what the lesson of Bell's theorem is. You know, what should we conclude based on the fact that we violate these Bell inequalities and this cannot explain what's going on? So I'm going to say a little bit about kind of some disagreements we have about that and where most of the researchers at this conference land, I think. So this is what the causal model for the Bell scenario looks like. Again, I stipulate the conditional probability of every variable given its parents. So this is the distribution over the outcomes given the settings I expect. And in addition to the inequalities, I have just independence relations. So these just follow from D separations in the DAG. So Alice's outcome X is independent of Bob's setting T, even given Alice's settings S, that's this, and vice versa. And then, of course, we have these Bell-type inequalities, which in this case, where both the outcomes and the settings are binary, are summarized by Clauser-Horn-Shimoni-Holt inequalities of this form, and seven others that are just sort of symmetric permutations of this one. Okay, so if it's not this, what could it be? One idea is that we have to assume some other causal hypothesis like this one, where the left setting influences the right outcome. And from a causal inference perspective, that's certainly a possible explanation. It can account for this data. So if I, you know, modify the model, now Y can depend on S, not just T. And so now if I ask what are the constraints on this, the only constraint is that I should still have this conditional independence of X and T given S. But S and Y don't need to be conditionally independent given T any longer. And I certainly don't need to respect any CHSH or Bell-type inequalities any longer. So I can explain their violation. But there's something uncomfortable about this model, which is that whenever you look at the predictions of quantum theory, you see that you still have that other conditional independence in the data. So you always find that Y is independent of S given T. So in the quantum physicists call that no signaling. And the only way to explain that in this model is to basically choose a set of measures zero of parameter values to ensure that it holds. So that's a kind of fine tuning. And it's a reason, it's in the language of causal inference, I guess that's called the failure of faithfulness. So that's a reason to think that this is perhaps not the best model. But it's not the reason that's usually given. The reason that's usually given is that we can do the experiment in such a way that the two labs are space-like separated. So to imagine that Alice's setting could influence Bob's outcome is to imagine that there are causal influences that go faster than the speed of light. And that's usually considered problematic. Some people try to get out of that and say, well, the only thing that ought not to go faster than the speed of light is just signals. And this can't be used to send signals. But nonetheless, most people agree that this is sort of in tension with the spirit of relativity, which is that causal influences, not just signals, not just anthropomorphic things like messages, but causal influences themselves shouldn't go faster than the speed of light. So I would say this is the main reason that people find this kind of causal explanation unsatisfactory. And so generally, it's thought that this is, by some people, that this is not a plausible explanation of what's going on. And so you can go looking for other causal structures. But you'll find that basically, no matter what you draw here, as long as it's a classical causal model, you can show that it has to be fine-tuned to explain these correlations we see in quantum theory. So you can give reasons why all of those are also implausible. And that has led many people to say the right causal explanation is something quite different. Namely, it's conservative about the causal structure. And it's basically, Bell got it right. It's just a common cause. But the model, the framework in which you describe causal models has to change. And in particular, we don't just describe the common cause by some variable about which we have some uncertainty, but something more exotic. So what's the more exotic thing? I'll call it a quantum causal model. And I've drawn it here to look like a classical causal model. So I have, instead of conditional probabilities, I have these rows. And they are now matrices. So they're operators or matrices in a complex Hilbert space. The Hilbert space is a tensor product of Hilbert spaces associated with each of these variables in the subscript. So in this case, x, s, and lambda. For the classical variables, like s, t, x, and y, I can just take everything to be diagonal matrices and some specified basis of that Hilbert space. But for lambda, I'm going to imagine things might be not diagonal. So that's where the real predictions of quantum theory come in. And so I have something analogous to the Markov condition, where I can take the product of these matrices. The analog of summing over the values of a variable becomes tracing over the Hilbert space associated with that guy. And this is an algorithm for computing joint probabilities of the outcomes given the settings. Another way to write this same condition, here I've got this sort of constraint that these operators have to commute. But another way of writing that is just to say that this common cause, this quantum common cause, can be thought of as being two pieces, an A and a B, and A goes to Alice, B goes to Bob. And their conditionals just depend on the piece they get. And the state of the common cause is just some state, a quantum state over AB. So this could be an entangled state over AB. And that the formula looks like this. So that, in the context that we're usually talking about, where the common cause can be of arbitrary dimension, so that's the analog of how in causal inference we typically allow for those latent variables to have arbitrary cardinality. In that context, this is exactly the same as what I showed you a moment ago. And for the quantum physicists, it would more conventionally be written like this, where the conditional of x given s and a is just a measurement on a with outcome x and setting s. And I usually write that as a positive operator valued measure. So the thing up at the top left there. I wonder if my hockey stick is around. We have pointers that are hockey sticks. Here it is. There we go. So this is usually a positive operator valued measure, which is the most general way of representing a measurement in quantum theory. So is this, and this is just the usual Born rule. So what I was writing before is just another way of expressing exactly the same thing. And for the experts, you know, these operators are just the Choi-Jamolkowski isomorphic operators to the maps that these POVMs would define. But I like writing it these kinds of ways because it makes the analogy to the classical case more apparent. So many people have worked on expressing this formalism, quantum generalization of causal models, including Costa and Shrapnel and the group of John Barrett in particular. Robin Lorenz is here this week. And there are some differences between these proposals, but for these kinds of questions, they all coincide. Okay, so this is the idea of how we're going to keep the conventional, the conservative causal structure, but make the parameters exotic. And when we do that, we find that we can reproduce the conditional independence relations that we see in the experiment, and we can violate the CHSH inequalities all the way up to 1 half plus 1 over 2 root 2, which is about 85%, which is exactly what quantum theory predicts is the maximal violation. And that's not a surprise because this framework was designed to reproduce the predictions of quantum theory. It was just sort of taking the formalism of quantum theory and recasting it in the framework of causal models. Okay, so the idea then would be that if you're looking for a causal explanation of this data, this is the one you should go for, that it's conservative on the structure side but exotic on the parameter side. Okay, so this is how I want to draw out the parallel between the two sorts of projects. If I draw a bell-type DAG here, and I don't label the settings and the outcomes, you know, because I'm not going to tell you whether these are the variables that an economist is looking at or whether they're the outcomes and settings of an experiment, and you see that your statistical data violates a bell inequality, then you're going to react to that in two ways depending on which community you're from. So if you're a quantum physicist and you know that you've done your experiment in a way that this is clearly the right causal structure because you were careful to do these things at space-like separation, and you believe that relativity theory is a constraint on causal influences, then you'll say, aha, that violation of Bell inequalities has witnessed the quantumness of the source. If I didn't know whether the experimentalist had prepared the source carefully enough with enough entanglement, I can say the violation of Bell inequalities now attest to the fact that there really was some quantumness in that experiment, and I can't explain it classically. But if I'm an economist or an epidemiologist and I know that my variables are classical and there's no quantum effects going on at all, then what I'm going to react when I see this inequality violation is that, well, that was just my first causal hypothesis, and now that I've seen that violation, I realize it was false. I have to appeal to a different hypothesis. So you might shift your hypothesis to this one, where for the particular variables you're interested in, there's, you know, no violation of relativity to assume that. It's just some influence that you didn't think was there the first time around when you wrote down this hypothesis. So the point is that Bell inequalities are tools that can be used by both communities. They're used for slightly different purposes, and quantum physicists use them mostly to witness quantumness, but you can also use them classically to falsify your first causal hypothesis, which was this one. Okay, so we can do the same thing with the instrumental scenario. Again, I'll leave the nodes unlabeled. If you violate some instrumental inequality and you know it's not this, then classically you might say, all right, that witnesses the need for a different causal structure like this one with the extra arrow. But it's also true that it could be by virtue of witnessing quantumness, that maybe the causal structure was right, but I need to allow for a quantum common cause. And in fact, it's been shown in these papers that there are certain instrumental inequalities, namely Bonnet inequalities, that can be violated quantum mechanically. And so you can set up experiments that clearly do have this causal structures, but violate the Bonnet inequalities. And then the right conclusion is that that shows that your common cause in that experiment was truly quantum. Similar thing with this causal structure. So we call this the triangle causal structure. A lot of quantum physicists have worked on this example. You can violate inequalities there too. And that might witness the need for a different causal structure in a classical context, or it might be witnessing quantumness, depending on the setting. And again, here it's been shown by Tobias Fritz that it is possible to find inequalities that are violated by allowing some of these common causes to go quantum. And in fact, recently there was an experiment done to show the violation of those inequalities and witness the quantumness. Okay, so that's the pattern. That's my account of why we're sort of working on similar problems. This is just a bunch of causal structures, a sort of random sampling of causal structures that do admit of these gaps between what you can achieve classically and what you can achieve quantumly. So that's one of the questions we're really interested in, is like which causal structures have inequalities and which ones of those admit gaps. And the evidence so far is that the causal structures that admit inequalities are kind of generic, and furthermore, that these quantum classical gaps also seem to be generic, that's the common thing. But there's still more to be proven here. We don't have a full understanding of when exactly there are these gaps. So, yes?
I have a question. So if what you said is true, wouldn't it be easier to do the list the other way, list graphs where it's known there is no gap?
Sure. That's part of it, that you list all the ones where you know there's no gap. And then of the ones that are remaining, what tools do you have for figuring out, which have gaps, which do not? So that's certainly part of it.
Just that you know.
Well, I think in Marina's talk this afternoon, she'll mention a little bit about rules to show the equivalence of different DAGs with hidden variables. And so if you manage to show that the DAG you're interested in is equivalent to one that has no hidden variables, well, then, of course, it's just equality constraints. There's no inequalities. There's a result by Henson, Law, and Pusey that shows that all the quantum causal models will have exactly the same equality constraints as the classical ones, at least the ones that come from deseparation. But actually, that generalizes to the ones that come from nested Markov conditions. So equality constraints are not going to do it for you. You need to find the ones that have inequality constraints. Those are the ones where you have a prospect of a quantum violation. So part of what we do is, apply these equivalence rules. And whenever you show that something's equivalent to latent free, you know it's not interesting in the sense of admitting a gap.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, so why are we interested? Let me just very briefly say, the reason witnessing quantumness is useful is that quantum information theory has shown that quantumness is a resource. And in fact, violating Bell-type inequalities is one of our most stringent notions of being, truly inexplicable classically and therefore, truly a resource for certain applications. So one type of application would be quantum networks, where you might have a bunch of nodes and different parties, sharing quantum resources like entanglement. And so you might, instead of analyzing this sort of pair by pair, you might want to say, I know something about the causal structure of that network. Now let me try to get all the resourcefulness out of whatever quantum states these parties share. So that is, these tools are very well suited to that kind of problem. Another kind of problem is if you're talking about quantum computation, then you can think of a circuit as embodying a particular causal structure. And again, if you want to show that you have a computational advantage over classical models, one way to do that is to try to say that the kinds of correlations you can get out of this circuit would not be explainable under the same causal structure if things were classical. So you, again, witnessing quantumness here can be a a way of witnessing that you have something that's a resource for quantum computation. But the other application I would say, and the one that I work mostly on, is just on the foundational side, you know, just how we think about quantum theory. Einstein's theory of general relativity and quantum theory have yet to be unified. And Einstein's theory of general relativity is very much about causal structure. It has dynamical causal structure. So what I like to say is, if you can't even understand what the right causal explanation of Bell's experiment is, then you probably have a problem trying to unify in general relativity and quantum theory. So a better understanding of causation in quantum theory will help with that project, and I think many other projects in physics. And in particular, my own take on it is that quantum theory basically involves a generalization to our notions of causation and inference beyond the classical notions, in much the same way that relativity taught us that our pre-relativistic notions of space and time were deficient and they needed to be generalized in some particular way. So this is my sense as to what's going on in quantum theory. And I could speak for a long time about that, but I won't do that today. OK, so that's the end of the kind of introduction as to why we're interested in the same kinds of problems. And now I thought I would say something about kind of the tools we have, or maybe the particular expertise that people coming from quantum physics have for solving problems of interest to people who do classical causal inference. So that expertise is all deriving inequalities, right, in the presence of hidden variables, because that's the history of Bell's theorem. That, you know, when basically Bell did his work in the 60s, and since then there have been thousands of papers written about Bell's theorem, because it's one of the most significant results in the foundations of quantum theory. And so people have thought very hard about Bell's theorem and how to derive inequalities and how to generalize Bell's theorem in various ways. So there's a lot of stuff there to be leveraged if you say, oh, now I want to take this and think about it from the perspective of causal inference and how I can derive inequalities for generic causal structures. There's just a lot of fruitful ground. So I wanted to talk a little bit about strategies for deriving inequalities in the presence of hidden variables. So the first strategy is the kind of brute force way, where you implicitize parameters that refer to the hidden variables. Okay, so let's take Bell as an example. So there's the Bell structure again. If I want to find constraints on the things that I observe by eliminating reference to the parameters that are unobserved, so all these conditionals involve lambda in some way, which is unobserved, then the first thing I need to do is I can't allow the cardinality of the set of values that lambda takes to be arbitrary. I need to bound that cardinality. And so I can do that by noticing, so I'm gonna switch to a circuit kind of depiction here. I'm going to assume that S, T, the settings, X, Y, the outcomes are all binary. And this causal structure I drew just means I can think of lambda as being copied and sent over here, and then some process that acts on S and lambda to generate the outcome X, and some other process that acts on T and lambda and generates Y. There's some distribution over lambda and some conditionals here. OK, so I've just redrawn what I had before. And the point is that I can always assume that these processes are deterministic without loss of generality. So I can just put whatever noise you want to encode in here, pull it back into this source if I like. Okay, so I can make these guys deterministic, some function f and g, put all the uncertainty into this p of lambda. And then finally, I can say that it's enough to imagine that this lambda just controls what function map from s to x is acting. So because these are binary, there's only four possible functions from S to X, you know, identity, flip, reset to 0, reset to 1, that's it. So that's the range that F can take. And then I can make this common cause just stipulate a distribution over this function and the corresponding function over here. So there's only 16 possibilities for these two functions. So the hidden variable can have cardinality 16, and it can explain everything that could happen here. All right. So I can rewrite what I see, the observed distribution of outcomes given settings, in terms of these deterministic dependencies and with the distribution over these possible functions. In the kind of quantum foundations literature, people think of these as like local instruction sets for what should happen on each wing. But obviously, this is similar to what happens in causal inference literature as well, just for the case of the Bell scenario. So we know that lambda has this cardinality 16. I can write it this way. Now let me just rewrite things. I'll just a simpler notation for the observed distribution, where again, everything's binary. The Qs now will be referring to the different elements of this distribution over the latent variables. So the latent variable lambda, which is now this f and g, identity flip, reset to zero, reset to one are the possibilities. And so now what I just get is a long list of equations that say, all right, what's the probability that the outcomes will both be zero when the settings are both zero? Well, that'll occur if the function on the left and the right are both reset to zero, regardless of what the setting is. It'll occur if the function on the left and right are both identity, because then when the settings are both zero, the outcomes will track them and they'll both be zero. And it also occurs when the function on the left is reset to zero, the function on the right is identity, or left identity and reset to zero on the right. So these are the only four possibilities for that pair of functions that will contribute to this probability. And I can go through the list and write down exactly which functions lead to each possible pattern of outcomes given settings. And what I get is a list of 16 equalities. I have to add, of course, the inequality on the Qs, that they have to be probabilities. So I get my 16 linear equalities and inequalities. And then I can do linear quantifier elimination and just eliminate the Qs and derive equations on the Ps, inequalities on the Ps. And so this is one of the ways in which Bell inequalities have traditionally been derived. And so that's how I get this CHSH inequality I showed you before. And as I said, the seven other symmetric counterparts of that, the result of this linear quantifier elimination. Okay, so the question is, how much does that generalize to other cases? Well, for certain other causal structures, like say this one here, so I first saw this one in a paper by Robin Evans. So around here, we call it the Evans scenario. So again, if I think of it as a circuit, I'm copying B, I have a lambda and a gamma which get copied out, one goes to B, one goes to C, and so on. So it is possible to think about this as there's some function H that determines how C depends on B. So that's what this hidden variable is. It just determines the distribution over the functions H. And then here, there's a function B given H, which I'll call F. And here there's a function of A given B, which I'll call G. And so here I can just write a distribution over F and G. And that is general, right? I can describe any causal model in this kind of way. And so I now have, if these are all binary, four possibilities here, four possibilities for F and for G. So that's like 64, cardinality 64 total. So I'd have to eliminate all those variables. If you can do this kind of thing in a DAG, then it's called gearable. This is terminology also invented by Robin Evans. And sometimes you don't have that. Like this triangle scenario is not gearable. So you can't think of the cardinality of the latent variables that way. But what you can do, so this is some work by Ellie and collaborators. There are other techniques for figuring out what cardinalities are sufficient for generating all distributions in the triangle. And in particular, in this case, if each of the latents have at least six values, that's enough to get you all the distributions for binary A, B, and C. So again, you could, in principle, do quantifier elimination. But the real problem is that both of these cases involve your unknown variables in a nonlinear way, right? So the Bell was nice because I just had the probability of lambda appearing linearly in all those equations, where here I have products of these parameters. So to eliminate them, I have to do nonlinear quantifier elimination, and that's computationally really hard. And so this kind of approach, the brute force quantifier elimination, just does not work well for anything except the simplest causal structures where you have one latent variable. Okay, so this is the kind of, this is an algorithm that would get you your answer, but it's infeasible. So the question is, what tricks can you use to solve this problem without doing nonlinear quantifier elimination? So one of the tricks has been worked on a lot by quantum physicists. So here's a list of some of the references, which switches to entropies. So I'll just briefly tell you how the idea works, is that rather than use the distribution over the observed variables, you look at the entropy vector. So if I have a bunch of variables x1 through xn, the entropy vector is the vector of the entropies of the singletons, the entropies of the pairs of variables, the entropies of the triples, et cetera, up to the entropy of all the variables. So it's just, entropies of the power set of the original set, where, of course, the entropy is defined. We're just talking about the Shannon entropy here. Okay, and it turns out that, you know, this set of vectors is constrained. You know, if I write down a generic distribution, not every entropy vector arises as the entropies of some valid probability distribution. So there are constraints on what kinds of entropy vectors you can get. That's called the entropy cone, the closure of the set of vectors you can get. It's characterized by linear inequalities. It's a convex cone. And it's hard to characterize, but we can characterize an outer approximation to it pretty easily called the Shannon cone, which is the cone that satisfies Shannon inequalities, which are all the inequalities on entropies that follow. There's many ways of describing it, but one way is they follow from these two facts about entropy. So monotonicity and submodularity. So these will all give me valid constraints on entropy vectors. And you can show that they're an outer approximation to the entropy cone. There are other inequalities that are not captured. These are called non-Shannon type, first discussed in this paper here. So they certainly don't, we know they don't characterize the entropy cone exactly. But you know, they still tell you some constraints on the entropies. So this is an example. If I just have three variables, x, y, z, then this would be this generates a set of equations which are linear equalities, inequalities on these guys. You can read about that in this paper. So the technique now for deriving inequality constraints from a particular causal structure, because all I've talked about now is just constraints on entropies that come from being consistent with some distribution. For a particular causal structure, you take all the constraints on the observed and latent variables that are implied by the causal structure. So typically we get conditional independence relations that follow from deseparation in the particular causal structure. So I take all those equality constraints, the conditional independence relations, they will imply linear equality constraints on the components of the entropy vector. I add all these linear inequalities of Shannon type, and then I do my quantifier elimination. So I try to eliminate all the entropies that refer to latent variables, because those are not, I want to have just constraints on the ones that refer to the observed variables. So you can call the result of that quantifier elimination problem the marginal Shannon cone. And the beauty of it is that ultimately, by taking entropies, you've turned products of probabilities into sums, and so you're doing the easier type of quantifier elimination, which is the linear quantifier elimination. So here would be an example. If we have the triangle, and we ask, what are all the conditional independence relations that hold among observed and latent variables? It would be these six here, and they all include reference to the latent variables. There's no conditional independence relations that refer only to the observed guys. And so then I can just turn the crank, and I can say, all right, given this conditional independence, it has an implication that the mutual information between A and B given mu is zero. That's just a complicated equality constraint on the entropies. I can add Shannon-type inequalities to derive this kind of inequality. I can do the same thing with another independence, derive this inequality, add these two equations together, get this inequality. Turns out Shannon-type inequalities allow me to simplify. And then finally, I use the fact that mu and lambda are independent given the empty set to set this guy to zero. And that gives me, finally, an inequality that refers only to the observed guys. So I went through that quickly, but you can turn it into an algorithm. Just take the Shannon-type inequalities, take all the equalities that follow from your conditional dependences, do quantifier elimination, and you'll get valid entropic inequalities for your causal structure. So this one was derived by Tobias Fritz. Okay, so that's one way you can get inequalities. And as I said, the trick is that you're only doing the easy type of quantifier elimination here. Unfortunately, from the quantum side, we were hoping that we would get inequalities that we could then violate quantumly and thereby sort of see the gap between what you can achieve quantumly and classically. But it turned out that the kinds of inequalities you get from these entropy cone techniques generally don't distinguish between classical and quantum models. So those sorts of inequalities tend to be valid even in the quantum model, that you can't violate them quantumly. So they're not so useful. I mean, they're still very useful for sort of characterizing what's compatible with that causal structure, but you're characterizing it in a theory-independent way, and if you want to witness quantumness, you need stronger inequalities that really characterize what can be achieved classically so that you can show how to go beyond it quantum mechanically. Okay, so the second strategy is to instead implicitize parameters that refer to, broadly speaking, counterfactual possibilities rather than to the latent variables. So I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that. So let me first remind you of the marginal problem, because that's going to show up here in a big way. So if I ask you, is there some joint distribution over x, y, z that has these three marginals on x, y, y, z, and x, z, where these, the first marginal is perfectly correlated, the other two are describe perfect anti-correlation. So my notation here, I should say, is that these square brackets just mean a Kronecker delta for the two variables on those values. Is there a joint distribution that has these guys as its marginals? The answer is yes. It's just this one, 0, 0, 1 plus 1, 1, 0. If you calculate the three marginals, you'll find the first two are perfectly correlated, and any other pair is perfectly anticorrelated. Whereas if I substitute the first marginal with the anticorrelated distribution, and I ask the same question, the answer comes back, no, there is no distribution that has those as marginals. Because if I look at every possible triple of values that x, y, and z could take, I find that I always have some pair of them that are correlated. They can't all be anticorrelated, right? Whereas this distribution had every pair being anticorrelated. So this is an example of, you know, a couple of versions of the marginal problem, just deciding whether a given set of marginals is compatible with some overall joint distribution. Okay, so if you want to know how do I generically find constraints on marginals, again, it's a quantifier elimination problem. So it turns out that if you just ask for binary XYZ, what are the constraints on the singleton and pairwise marginals, it's exactly this. The singleton marginals has to be consistent with the pairwise marginals, and there's some non-trivial inequalities that have to be satisfied of this form. And the way you get there is very simple. You just write out all these marginal probabilities in terms of the joint probability over three variables that you assume exists, right? So the marginal on XY has to be the marginalization over Z of this joint distribution. That joint distribution has to all be valid probabilities. So I can do linear quantifier elimination on this, get rid of all the Qs, and just find constraints on the Ps. And when I do that, I get exactly what I just showed you.
Is the linear quantifier elimination, is that what I would call Möbius inversion?
What you would call what?
Möbius inversion, I wonder, because that's what you get if you use the Möbius inversion.
An algorithm for this that's very efficient is called Fourier-Motzkin elimination. So is Fourier-Motzkin elimination the same as Möbius inversion?
It's not the same, but because this one, these ones follow all of by Möbius form, because these marginals are Möbius parameters of any binary distribution, and you have this, and the constraints on the Möbius parameters are exactly that certain things are positive.
Right, right.
And they look, they're exactly like that in this particular way. I just wondered whether.
Well, let me put it to everybody else. Does anybody know whether this is the same as Möbius inversion? Anyone online?
I mean, I think my take on this, I mean, Möbius is just how they, like, you know, Rob Evans and Thomas parameterized bidirectional graphs, for example.
Exactly, that's what they do, yeah.
And I think my take on that is, because those parameters are like, look at all connected sets. Let's look at all subsets of variables and just parameterize the probability that any margin you're applying to the set at zero, like that probability is a parameter.
I see.
And then because they're marginal parameters, I think my take on Stefan's question is because they're marginal parameters and because these have to be satisfied by margins, that's why they come up there, basically. So I guess you could think of it that way.
Yeah, but this isn't a special case, but I mean, you can take any general probability distribution on a binary cube. And you can write it, either you can write them all the margins as parameters, and you can use the probabilities themselves as parameters, and they're related by the Möbius inversion.
Yeah, because they become a subset, the function of the subset. Yeah,
exactly. So therefore you get, and one of them, because one of them are sort of elementary ones, so they can be anything positive, and the other ones, of course, you get inequalities because the Möbius has this sort of sign change. I mean, if you have, you only have three, but if you have sort of a million, right? You still go even odd, even odd, even odd, etc. It goes like that.
Okay.
I'm wondering I was just wondering whether it was something I knew or something to learn.
I mean, I'm certainly thinking of it as just as a particular simple instance of the generic quantifier, linear quantifier elimination. Whenever I have a set of linear equalities and linear inequalities, which I do here, all the q's appear linear, then generally I can do this efficiently and figure out what the constraints are just on the p's. Yeah.
The Zoom participants cannot hear questions by
asking. Oh, okay. Thank you. All right, so I will do that henceforth.
I also think that this Mobius parameterization, physicists also have an analog, which is Collins-Chase annotation in the Bosnian area, where we can either represent events by the probabilities of multivariate outcomes, and the same probabilities of all of them, or we can say if there's two or three or more outcomes, you only give the probabilities of marginals, but never for the probabilities involving the last outcomes. It's probabilities for all marginals, but never specifying the probability for the final outcome. I assume it's a similar scheme between converting between these two notations.
Right. Okay, so something to talk about. So that's I just wanted to give this simple example of the marginal problem because this is going to be the workhorse of kind of quantifier elimination for techniques that refer to these counterfactual possibilities. And so these techniques, I would say, that they're a way that quantum physicists have thought about Bell's theorem for a long time. And so recently, Ellie and me and Tobias Fritz have tried to generalize these techniques into, just being able to handle generic causal structures. And so we call that the inflation technique for causal inference with hidden variables. So I'm going to start by telling you about the inflation technique, and then I'm going to show how it sort of where its roots in analyzing Bell's theorem comes from. So first of all, I need to tell you what an inflation DAG is. So if I'm interested in this DAG, so I've changed my notation a little bit, but this is still the triangle DAG with A, B, and C observed. X, Y, and Z are now the latent variables. If this is the one I'm interested in deriving inequalities for, then I draw a different DAG, which has copies of all, potentially has copies of every variable I'm interested in. It could be some subset of the variables. So there's, two copies of X in this example, two copies of A, et cetera. And the important thing is that the ancestry of every copy of some variable in the original DAG mimics what it was in the original DAG. So if I look at A1, for example, and I look at its ancestors, it depends on X1 and Y1. So it depends on a copy of X and a copy of Y. And that's exactly the same ancestral subgraph as A had in the original DAG. Or if I look at C2, for example, its ancestral subgraph is exactly what C was in the original DAG. So this is the generic definition, which is that if G prime is an inflation of G, then for all nodes in G prime that are sort of copies of A, so I'll call them A sub I, the ancestral subgraph in G prime of A sub I has to be equivalent up to these indices to the ancestral subgraph of A and G. That's the idea. So here are a few examples. This is the cut inflation of the triangle, where only one variable, Y, has been turned into two copies. But A depends on an X and a Y, B depends on a Z and a Y, just like it did originally. It's just that here A and B don't depend on the same Y, whereas here they did. This is the one I already showed you, called the spiral inflation. This is another one where every observed variable depends on some pair of the latent variables with this kind of structure. Okay, so that's an inflation DAG. And now let me describe what an inflation model is. So if I have some model M on DAG G, meaning some scope of possibilities for the parameters, so the way that every variable could depend on its parents probabilistically, then in the inflation model, I write down a similar structure. But now whenever I have some parameter, like this one here, the distribution over y1 or y2, I impose this symmetry constraint that the scope of possibilities for this and this are exactly as they were here. But furthermore, these two things are equal in this DAG, right? So they have to be, this y1 has to be sampled from the same distribution that y2 is sampled from. If I go to the spiral inflation, then now there's, I have a parameter for how A1 depends on X1, Y1, parameter for how A2 depends on X1 and Y2, and I have the symmetry constraint that those conditionals have to be exactly the same in the model. Similarly here and here, and for the X's and the Y's and the Z's. Okay, so essentially I've got this inflated structure together with these extra symmetry constraints, relative to an arbitrary model having that structure. And that's the inflated model. Okay, so this is just me formalizing it, which is that if for all ai and aj that are in the graph G prime, the way ai depends on its parents has to be the same as the way aj depends on its parents. Okay, so now that I've defined that, it'll turn out that there are some interesting sets of variables in the inflated DAG, which we call injectable, which are no longer singleton sets, but they have exactly the same sorts of distributions that you would see in the original DAG. So A2 and C1 are an example of an injectable set because they have exactly the same ancestry as A and C do in the original DAG, even though that's not guaranteed by the inflation. All we demanded in the inflation DAG was that singleton variables have the same ancestry. But it happens sometimes for some inflations that more than singletons have the same ancestry. So we call those injectable sets. So B1 and B2 is not an example of an injectable set because there's nothing corresponding to B1 and B2 back in the original. For B2 and C2, well, there is a B and a C back in the original, but look, this ancestry is not the same because their Zs are different, whereas here they'd be the same. So B2 and C2 are not an injectable set either. Okay, so the point is that these injectable sets are interesting because if I look at the scope of possibilities for distributions over one of them, it's exactly the same as in the original, right? So this is the formula for the joint over A1, C1 over here. It involves the conditionals A1 given its parents, C1 given its parents, times the distributions over the latents. And over in the original, this is what the joint over A and C would look like. And because these range over the same scope of possibilities, and so do these, et cetera, these range over the same scope of possibilities. So it's exactly the same set of possibilities for that joint distribution. Okay, so if you tell me that a particular marginal on AC is compatible with this model over here, then necessarily taking the distribution over A1, C1 to be equal to that will give me something that's compatible over here. Because when you've told me it's compatible, you told me there exists some choices of parameters that yield it through this formula. And if you've told me that, then I know that there exists some choice of parameters over here that'll yield the same distribution through this formula. Okay, so that's the key, that these injectable sets have the special feature that compatibility in the original DAG implies compatibility in the new DAG. And if I look at one that's not injectable, like A1 and B1 over here in this cut inflation, this is what it looks like over in that model. It factorizes, and therefore it's different from what AB is in the original model. So compatibility of some distribution over here does not imply compatibility of the same distribution over there. I can't infer compatibility for these kinds of sets. So what it means is that if you go and find all the injectable sets, so in this case, this simple example, this is all of them, these three singletons and these pairs, then if you give me a 5-tuple of marginals that are compatible over here, that same 5-tuple will be compatible over here. I just sort of went through that logic. Similarly for the spiral inflation, now you got way more, a larger set of these injectable sets. And you have the same thing, that if you have compatible marginals on them here, that implies compatible margins over here. So here's how this works. If I want to witness incompatibility, this is what I do. Let's say I take this as a simple example. Joint distribution, perfect correlation between A, B, and C. I'm going to assume compatibility and derive a contradiction. That's how this is going to work. This logic I'm about to take you through was first given in this Henson, Lal, and Pusey paper. So if this joint distribution is compatible, then the marginals on AC and BC, remember those were examples of injectable sets, will of this form, right? Just I compute those marginals, they're perfectly correlated. They will be compatible with this causal structure. And now that means, by the sorts of inferences we were talking about, that the same marginals are going to be compatible over on the right. Okay. So I've just written out those marginals explicitly. So now I have to assess whether these guys are compatible with here. And that this is where I get my contradiction. It turns out these marginals on A1C1 and B1C1 are not compatible with this DAG over here. Why is that? Well, if A1 and C1 are perfectly correlated and B1 and C1 are perfectly correlated, then you have no choice. A1 and B1 also have to be perfectly correlated. This is just an aspect of the marginal problem, right? That not any old triple of marginals is possible. And in particular, if you've got these two marginals, you have to have this one. And this is not a valid marginal for this DAG, because in this DAG, A1 and B1 are deseparated by the empty set, so I expect them to be conditionally independent. And in this distribution, they're not. So that shows me that, you know, these marginals are not compatible with this guy over here. And so I can pull that result back and say, therefore, these marginals are not compatible here either. Because we're talking about distributions over these special sets where compatibility here implies compatibility there, incompatibility here implies incompatibility over here. And that, of course, in turn shows me that this original distribution I was interested in can't be compatible with this guy either because it has these marginals. Okay, so that's the basic pattern of how this works. You find some injectable sets, so S prime is a set of injectable sets. You find their images back in the original model, and you know that any marginal distributions over those guys back in the original model, if they're compatible, the corresponding ones will be compatible over here. So any incompatibility you prove over here will imply incompatibility back in the original. Okay, so that's you now have the basic idea of how that inflation technique works. You can use it to also derive inequalities. Suppose I is an example of an inequality that acts on a family of distributions from this set S. If it happens that whenever those marginal distributions are compatible with your model, then this inequality is satisfied. In that case, I'll call it a causal compatibility inequality. So like a Bell inequality would be an example of this, or an instrumental inequality for the instrumental scenario. So say these are the things you're interested in. Well, we know from the definition of inflation that if I have compatibility with M, then the corresponding things will be compatible with M prime. So if you give me some causal compatibility inequality over on M prime, I know that those distributions are going to satisfy that inequality. But that means that those same distributions over on the original variables are going to satisfy the same inequality, which means that this inequality is also a compatibility inequality back in the original model. So in other words, you can if you derive any compatibility inequalities over in your inflated model M prime, you can pull them back to M. And they're valid inequalities in M as well. So this is an example. Again, it's my triangle with binary ABC. This, it turns out, is a valid causal compatibility inequality over here at M prime. I'll explain why in a moment. And so, and I can verify that it only refers to the singletons A1, B1, C1, and the pairs B1, C1, and A1, C1. This term still just involves the singletons. Those were all injectable, so I know that an inequality involving only those sorts of marginals can be pulled back to here. So how do I know that that is a valid inequality? This is where the marginal problem comes in. So I start by saying nothing to do with causal structure. If you just give me the pairs of marginals, the marginals on the pairs, A1, C1, B1, C1, A1, B1, then as I showed at the beginning, you know, this is an inequality constraint that has to be satisfied by those marginals. And you know, we got that just from linear quantifier elimination. And now I bring in the causal structure. I say, well, in this particular causal structure, A1 and B1 are deseparated by the empty set. So that implies that the joint over A1, B1 factorizes. That's where the causal structure comes in. So I just substitute that expression into that inequality, and I get the thing I showed you earlier, where now PA1, B1 factorizes here. So this is a causal compatibility inequality for that M prime model, which allows me to derive it here. And now this is strong enough to rule out, for example, that joint distribution that was my proof by contradiction a moment ago. This kind of inequality can rule that out. All right. You know, if you use inflations like the spiral inflation, you can do a similar trick. You can derive inequalities like this that are valid compatibility inequalities over here, and you can pull them back to valid compatibility inequalities over in the original DAG. This one here is, you know, it has the same kind of derivation as before. You start with some marginal constraint, all right? So it turns out this is a valid inequality on all joint distributions over these six variables. But then you use the causal structure, and you notice that there's certain deseparation relations in this graph, which implies certain factorizations, which I then plug in, and I get, you know, this inequality as a result. Okay, and all I've done is pull it back. Turns out this inequality can actually rule out what's called the W distribution for kind of quantum reasons, which is impossible to rule out by that other inequality, and generically, it's been a hard one to rule out. So what's the point? The point is that this technique does the quantifier elimination where it's easy, over at the level of the marginal problem, and just says, oh, okay, I want to know what marginals are, what marginal distributions are consistent with some overall joint distribution, derives linear inequality constraints on marginals. And then the way that these become polynomial inequalities is by using simple facts about the causal structure of the inflated DAG, right? So these are equality constraints, for instance, conditional independence relations, to substitute certain terms in the inequalities with, you know, polynomials, right? Like PAB gets substituted for PA times PB, that kind of thing. Plug those in and you get the polynomial inequalities. So it's a way of making sure that you're never faced with the hard quantifier elimination problem, which is the nonlinear one, that you do your quantifier elimination at the linear level and you translate it back to inequalities on the causal structure you're interested in. Okay. I want to wrap up soon. So let me just mention this technique. You can turn it into an algorithm. And Ellie and Miguel Navasquez have shown that this gives you actually a convergent hierarchy of tests. So if you go high up enough in the hierarchy, you get arbitrarily close to the set of distributions that are actually compatible with your DAG. And the history is that there's a lot of proofs in the quantum literature of Bell's theorem that have exactly this form. They don't try to eliminate parameters that refer to latent variables, but they instead sort of imagine something different, and then they leverage the marginal problem. So if you look at Fine's proof or Hardy's proof of Bell's theorem, what's called the GHZ proof, they all have this kind of structure, the Bronstein-Caves entropic inequalities. We can all recast those as an instance of this inflation technique. It's basically the same idea. And that's not a surprise because that's where we got the idea from. You know, we were working in the context of these sorts of things and we're trying to generalize them to arbitrary causal structures. I was thinking I might summarize some of these, but I'm just going to skip them and say a couple of words and then end about what happens when you allow these common causes to go quantum. Because everything I just told you, again, can be used by both communities to derive constraints that follow from classicality. You might use those constraints to witness quantumness. You might use them to just dispose of certain causal hypotheses in favor of others. But what if you want to say, well, what are the limits to what I can achieve with quantum common causes? So, you know, here's the bell, the triangle, the instrumental with these quantum common causes. It turns out that you can't typically get any old distribution of the observed variables. There's also a limit to what you can do, even if those causes go quantum. And so in the quantum community, we also want to know, how do I derive inequalities for that set, the bigger set that quantum theory allows? So remember, you know, that all we did to get quantum causal models was to allow the parameters to become exotic, not just conditional probabilities, but these conditional density operators. So it's the same sort of form that we would have classically, but where everything's an operator now. I can, again, rewrite it where every x, y, and z, the latent guys, get split into two parts. One part influences A, one part influences C. And then it looks like this. And you want to know now that as you vary over the choices of these parameters, what scope of possibilities for the joint distribution do you get? That's the question. Again, like in the classical case, we usually say, let's let the dimension of those quantum things be arbitrarily large. Yeah, there's a more specific question of, you know, what if the cardinality of the latent variables classically is fixed? What if we have the same thing in the quantum case where the dimension's fixed? And we'll hopefully spend some time talking about that this week. But the usual problem that people focus on is where the dimension's general. And you can use similar techniques. You can use this entropy cone technique. All that changes is that although submodularity is satisfied by quantum entropies, monotonicity is not in general. It gets replaced by something called weak monotonicity. So you can derive inequalities from those. And if the inequality you derived classically didn't depend on monotonicity in any way, then it's going to be quantumly valid. And if it did, then it's conceivable you'll get something slightly different when you go to your quantum model. You can also use the inflation technique if the inflation is of a particular form. So here was two inflations I talked about. And from a quantum perspective, they're very different, because over here, a latent variable like x gets copied and sent to multiple copies of A. If I think of that quantumly, right, so I just make all these quantum systems, that would be like copying some quantum state of a system. And there's something in quantum mechanics called the no cloning theorem. You can't do that. So this is not an inflation that you can hope to use over on the quantum side, but this one is. And if you go through the details of the proof that I gave you for this inequality, none of it cared about the nature of the parameters in the model. The only place where the model parameters came in was to assume that A1 and B1 would be independent in this causal structure. And that's still true in the quantum case. It doesn't matter that these latent variables have gone quantum. This is still true. And so that derivation still goes through. So that inequality is also valid in the quantum causal model. So some of the inequalities you derive from inflation, the ones that use these what we call non-fanout inflations, you know, like the cut here, they're still true in the quantum case. Whereas for other cases, like that spiral inflation, you know, the inequality we derived here, well, it's not necessarily true in the quantum case. It might turn out to be true. And in this case, I don't happen to know whether it is valid in the quantum case. But it doesn't have to be. And so it's an opportunity for a difference between the finding a difference between the classical set and the quantum set. I'm going to skip this, and just end with mentioning that there's something called the quantum inflation technique by these authors, which is a generalization of the Navasquez-Peronio-Assain hierarchy, which is a way of trying to characterize exactly the set of correlations that arise in the Bell scenario. So this is essentially taking the ideas of inflation to go from this technique in the Bell scenario to generic causal structures. And recently, there's been a convergence result for this, which hopefully we'll hear about from David Gross and Lawrence Lightheart later this week. And I think I'm just going to end there. And thanks for your patience. And I'll take any questions. Sure. Ilya, why don't you get started?
So just a really quick clarification question about inflation. So
yeah.
Just to make sure I understand. So the examples people always give for inflation is what like kind of bidirectional graph or presentable DAX, meaning that I have observed variables,
right,
hidden variables, and
yeah,
they're kind of bipartite, basically. So of course, in general,
yeah,
you've got that zoo on the slide where they weren't all like that. But I think
right,
it's without loss of generality that you can do this, right?
Yeah, you could say
reduce it to those bipartite cases.
No, when you say you can always reduce it, I wouldn't say that every causal structure can be recast as something with two layers. No, I agree that you can't do that. What I prescribed, the inflation technique that I described, I mean, you can apply that to any causal structure. You might not get so many interesting constraints out of it. Like the ones with this two-layer format are give you particularly strong constraints. Sorry. But maybe I've misunderstood your question.
So let's just be concrete. So the simplest example that is of that form is IB.
Yep.
Of course, IB you can split. Can split the treatment, and then it looks like the Bell graph again, which is the form.
Yeah. So this is let me not skip this bit.
I did see that.
Yeah. So there's an idea that's not quite inflation. Ellie likes to call it the interruption technique, and I think in your community this is really leveraging single world intervention graphs. And so you imagine changing your DAG, but in a way that doesn't necessarily preserve the ancestry. Like, so this X sharp variable here does not have the same ancestral subgraph as it did back in the original. But everything else does. And so it's not an inflation, but it's sort of in the same spirit. So, you know, this is distinguished. I think of this as the variable I'm intervening on. So it's, you know, if I'm intervening on a variable, it doesn't have to have the ancestry it did in the original graph. So now the parameters, again, are exactly the same scope of possibilities as they were back in the original. So y depends on lambda and x in the same way over here that y depends on lambda and x sharp. And I just, you know, set x sharp to whatever value I'm intervening on. And now the point is that, again, I'll find that there's certain probabilities over here that have exactly the same scope of possibilities here. So here, if I look at the joint over xy given z and x sharp, when I assign the same value to x and x sharp. So if I write that out, it's just the Markov form. I plug in the values of x anytime I see x or x sharp. And then I compare that to what I would see for just x and y given z here, it's exactly the same, right? Like this conditional here is exactly the same scope of possibilities as this conditional, similarly for the second term. So we know that it's the same sort of idea, that if you have a conditional x, y given z that you know is compatible here, then writing down the conditional x, y given z x sharp such that its projection when x and x sharp are the same value are exactly what I had over there, that's going to be compatible over here. So that's, it's the same spirit as what I said in inflation, slightly modified. And so when you do that, you can now leverage constraints derived over here and pull them back to constraints over here. So for example, if you use, like this is, as you said, just the Bell scenario. If I use the independence relations in the Bell scenario, like y independent of z given x, and x independent of x sharp given z, that kind of stuff, then those kinds of constraints give me just Perl-type inequalities. And nothing of, and because those independence relations still hold when this guy goes quantum, those inequalities are still valid quantumly. Whereas if I do something else, like if I use Bell inequalities over here, that's a valid causal compatibility inequality over here. And now I project onto the space where these guys are the same. So in the Bell language, that's projecting onto the case where Alice's outcome coincides with Bob's setting. And I project onto those, I'll get an inequality that's valid over here. And if I do that, I'll get Bonnet-type inequalities. Okay, so that's the big difference between Perl and Bonnet. And from this perspective, where did they come from? Did they come from equality constraints on the inflated guy or the interrupted guy or inequality constraints? These ones, because they came from those inequality constraints, and because I know I can violate Bell-type constraints quantumly, that's why I can get a quantum violation of the Bonnet inequality. So whereas the Perl-type inequalities don't admit of any quantum violation, these Bonnet inequalities do. And I think I've missed the reference here. This is a paper whose reference I gave earlier that Ellie is an author on. What's the first the name of the first author? Then I've forgotten. Anyways, you'll find that in this paper on the quantum instrumental scenario. So in general, I would say when you have these kinds of multi-layer guys, this technique tends to give you stronger results than the original inflation technique. Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah. You're answering a slightly different question, which is that, you know, single world, the Zwick splitting, mm-hmm. like, is in the same spirit in the sense that what you do is you construct an easier graph.
Yes.
Where it's easier to do the control positive in the other direction. So I kind of see that. And yeah. Inflation, of course, is sufficient to get everything. So maybe that's all we need to worry about. But I guess your answer is no. There is nothing significant about bipartite graphs. You can just apply the main graph.
Correct.
Okay, great.
Ellie, do you want to add anything to that answer, or are you?
No, I wouldn't add to that answer. I would to emphasize that maybe if you could wind back to where you had the Evans and triangle scenario expressed in terms of their quantifier elimination.
Yes.
Kind of hard to draw inequalities. I just think it's interesting to sort of keep in mind for the rest of the workshop that we might be able to sort of say, you know, here we assume unlimited cardinality for the hidden variables, and it turns out that we can basically choose a cardinality, a finite cardinality, without also generality. So in principle, once we have a finite cardinality, we can reduce the problem to this nonlinear quantifier elimination, albeit that that's not very tractable. And so then we probably need to become stuff where, again, sort of the entropies of the hidden systems are typically unbounded. But the same sort of formulation, we could sort of say, well, what if we had finite cardinality variables? We could express it in terms of nonlinear quantifiers, and so we would once again have sort of this same problem. But we have sort of a clear formulation of how we would handle that problem. Because the nonlinear quantifier elimination is basically explicitly putting in finite cardinality in variables, but we just choose a cardinality for which there's no also generality.
Okay.
There's another question, yeah.
Yeah, so thanks for the great talk. I really enjoyed it. So I have two questions. Actually, you hinted at answers to these questions already, but I want to ask more details. So the first thing is that I think so the second thing is that okay, the first thing is that at the beginning you mentioned that the quantum system can be taught as perhaps two, instead of lambda, A and B as two different variables, and
yes,
it resembles a lot of this inflation technique. So I guess motivation is coming from that. Is that correct?
No, I think that's something quite different in a way. That so it's let me see if how to answer this. The subtlety is that if you assume that your hidden variable is not arbitrary cardinality. So let's say I had a qubit, a two-level quantum system, and I wanted it to influence two other systems. You might think, well, it can never act as a non-trivial common cause because I got to either send it to Alice or send it to Bob. Like, how do I split a qubit in two? But in fact, there is a way where you can sort of imagine decomposing the Hilbert space of your qubit into a direct sum of two one-dimensional Hilbert spaces, and sort of each subspace gets factorized into one-dimensional spaces. And it's a bit like saying, oh, well, if I measured my qubit in some basis and then sent the outcome of that measurement to the two parties, then that would be a way of setting up a common cause. So it's not the case that I can always think of the quantum common cause as just, oh, I break it in two pieces and send them off. But when I allow that common cause to be arbitrary dimensionality, then there's no loss of generality in just saying, oh, yeah, I prepare some entangled guys, send some here, send some here. That's sufficient. And it's the way we usually think about the Bell scenario. So for a quantum audience, it's a bit more palatable to think of it as just two systems and they get sent off. But if we were talking about fixed dimension, then no, a common cause would be broken up in more general ways than that.
I see. OK. Yeah, I think I guess that because you said not all inflations give you quantum bonds, right?
Right. Like that's the part that connects with the no cloning theorem.
Right.
That and there I would just say that if I have, like, classically when I think of the inflation technique, I say, oh, I have this latent variable X, and now I want it to influence A and B. Classically I have no problem. I say, oh, I'm gonna make a copy of X and let A and B both see a copy. But in quantum mechanics, there's just no way of taking a single qubit, let's say, and have two other systems respond exactly to that qubit state. I can split it up, send the qubit to Alice, or send it to Bob, or split it in this way where I've measured it and sent it. But all of those do not correspond to both Alice and Bob getting the full qubit. That's where the no cloning theorem comes in.
So you're saying it cannot replicate the exact behavior. It can do maybe an after approximation. Is that right?
I would say the inflation technique is not well defined for any of these for any of these fan-out inflations, the ones where classically you would copy things, they're just not well-defined for quantum models. Like, I wouldn't know how to write down how A and B depend on lambda, both depend on lambda if lambda's a qubit. It just doesn't fit in the quantum formalism. So instead, we just say, look, inflation makes sense if you've got one of these non-fan-out inflations, then we can talk about what constraints we get, even if the latent variables are quantum. It does not make sense to talk about it for these other kinds of inflated DAGs. So on the quantum side, there's a restriction on the shape of your inflated DAGs.
I see. Okay, good. So thanks. The second question is this inflation technique, can it be, and I think there's a reference you just mentioned, that I was going to ask, can it be used to get tighter bounds on the entropy cone? Because you said, yes, entropy cone is a bunch of linear constants,
right,
infinitely many of them. So if we can get tighter bounds with this, that could be useful.
Yeah, so there is an interesting connection between the inflation technique and these non-Shannon type inequalities. So it turns out that if you look at the paper by Young on non-Shannon type inequalities, there's something there called the copy lemma, which is sort of the main thing they use. And in our paper on inflation, we point out one of the appendices that you can think of the copy lemma as a kind of result of the inflation technique. So that suggests that these kinds of ideas might be a way of finding new non-Shannon type inequalities. And I have a student who spent some time thinking about that. But thus far, I don't think we've made any real progress on that front.
Sounds like an open problem.
Yeah, yeah. But take a look at that appendix on the copy lemma, and I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Rob, there is an online question for you.
OK.
So Pedro says, I have a question for Professor Seconds, can we also have the same reduction, infinite to finite dimension, for quantum causal structures? For instance, can Alice and Bob have statistics with some infinite dimensional system that are not achievable with finite qubits?
That's a good question. So in general, I think on the quantum side, there are provably differences between imagining an infinite dimensional common cause and finite dimensional common cause. And so that's connected to, what's it called? Cyrilson's conjecture. David Gross, I think, is an expert on that sort of topic. I'm not, but there are certainly circumstances where you can get away with a finite dimensional quantum system and still generate all correlations. So like in the CHSH case, where I have a Bell scenario with binary settings, binary outcomes, I don't need to go to infinite dimensional quantum system to get all the possible correlations there.
But there are other cases where you do.
Yes.
So as soon as we have, let's say, three settings for each of the parties, mm-hmm. now there are Bell inequalities which achieve their maximum violation only asymptotically as the Hilbert space dimension shear increases. Mm. So the quantum case is qualitatively different. Like when we have
right.
finite observable variables, we can always get away with finite classical Hilbert variables, but we cannot always get away with finite
dimensional
Hilbert space dimension.
Earlier, you mentioned some areas where working on quantum causal models can have applications in quantum technologies.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other way around? Like having access to a quantum computer, can that help you do research in quantum causal models in any way?
That's a good question. I don't know. If I had to guess, I would say yes. That's just a guess. But let me tell you what my guess is based on. So there's an interesting set of techniques that have been developed in recent years where you fit to the parameters of your model using a neural network. But you can, in the context of causal inference, you can make the structure of your neural network reflect the causal structure. So if I'm in the triangle, I could say, well, the way I'm going to estimate these conditional probabilities is by building a neural network that has this kind of structure. And so I have sort of three neural networks that are trying to fit to each of these conditionals, and they each of them gets two inputs. Like one of them gets lambda and omega, one of them gets omega and gamma, and so on as inputs to those bits. And in general, when these variables become high cardinality and there's more of them, you're going to have to avail yourself of heuristics to find these best fit parameters. You're not just going to be able to do a method of steepest descent or something that like we could. Here, when you're actually trying to fit to data. And so my guess is if you're trying to do the same thing with quantum models, then maybe building a quantum machine learning system that's built on a quantum computer is adds efficiency. That would be my guess. I don't know. Okay, I think we should go to coffee.